Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody. This is Sorrow Gone Rogue. And first, I give my thanks to Craig Guthrie, my ever reliable sound engineer, who really keeps things ticking over to when everything else is not. And this morning, everything else seemed not to be ticking over. In all the years I've been coming to Chai FM studios, I have never had to do so many diversions in the traffic to get round queues and queues of cars. Word has it that it's a accident somewhere in the Corlett Drive area, and it's causing massive diversions backwards. But of course, what this highlights is, as you go through the roads and drive through Johannesburg, is how many patches of the road are under repair or reconstruction or whatever, however one best would describe it. And I don't know if I can only assume that it's all mostly, firstly, for the G20 summit in November, and secondly, for some sort of Hail Mary for the ANC to get voted back into power in Johannesburg in 2026, late and early, or early 2027. The going to be absolutely fascinating local government. But apropos of that, the Minister of Finance, Enoch Godongwana, has given the Josie Prime Minister, perhaps he behaves like it, the Joburg mayor, an ultimatum to put together a plan within the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks, can you believe it? To deal with and set out a plan for the city's, shall we say, chaotic finances, threatening to partially withhold Treasury funding if he fails to take decisive remedial action. Now, I'm not quite sure whether that there's actually an expectation that will happen, or just issuing a public rebuke will bring, you know, will get some sort of response from the mayor. But irrespective of the fact that most of the problems started many years ago and were just exacerbated while he's been in the position. He did actually promise he wouldn't do anything for us when he came in, and it seems that is true. And there's even under him, there's lots of scandal about things that have happened, tenders that have been awarded or shouldn't have been awarded or threatened to be awarded. So I don't know how they are going to do it. I mean, one of the things that we know they're looking at is a review of the leases to Marks Park and Killarney Country Club to optimize their use and essentially get more money out of them. Now, the leases, by all accounts, have been very, very low in number. But, you know, it's just a sign of how desperate they are. But almost to add insult to injury, the Al-Jamaa Party has recommend that its former mayor, I think he was mayor for about 3 months, if that, should come in and take over the finance portfolio, become the MMC for finance. Now, I think the reality is that no one without exceptional financial management skills, particularly in something as complex as the city, and a city like Johannesburg, can take over. And the idea of Thapelo Ahmed being the MMC is really funny. If I assume it's not seriously being considered by the ANC coalition, but it is a coalition party, so now's the time to make a demand, I guess. Well, we'll see. This is going to keep playing out over and over again.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, since we were last together, the tariff deadline by the United States has come into effect as of the 7th of August, and we are being struck with a tariff percentage of 30% tariff on goods brought into the USA from South Africa. Now, apparently that puts South Africa at double the average tariff level levied on the rest of the world. And if you think about the fact that a year ago, U.S. tariffs were just 2.4%, that this is a shakeup of monumental proportions. Now, South Africa is in the fifth highest tariff, has the fifth highest tariff rate, and it is grouped with countries like Algeria, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Libya. Now, about 69 countries on the list are being subjected to just half of South Africa's rate, and these include, go figure, Democratic Republic of Congo, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. It probably has a lot to do with minerals and those sorts of resources being sought from them, but whatever it is, our guys just didn't do it. Now, the lowest tariff level is 10%, and it's being applied against the Falkland Islands and the United Kingdom. And the highest tariff listed is 41%, which is being applied to Syria. Now, if you look at however bad our circumstances are, but if you look at our relative stability and democracy compared to the chaos that is Syria, it probably just puts our tariff rate of 30% into some sort of horrible perspective. Now, China, it seems to be being dealt with separately, and is currently sitting at nearly 55% by the US. So, you know, that's another area all on its own, which I don't pretend to know the details of the issue and where the parties are in that. But that's obviously a very specific area of concern for the US and China, and they seem to be benefiting or not on an alternating basis with regard to their negotiations on tariffs. Now, most African countries face lower tariffs than their Asian counterparts, so except for us, I guess. And it's partly indicates that the United States is trying to de-link manufacturing in the Southeast Asian area away from China and to achieve a greater integration with U.S. supply chains. That's the view for that information. So whether it will achieve anything or not, I don't know. But it does give us some idea of how badly South Africa has handled the situation. The proposals, or a so-called draft agreement, I think somebody referred to it as a signed agreement, which at best could mean signed by the South Africans, but not by the Americans, has announced what someone has described as a nondescript package of interventions. And this will happen because the government failed to get a lower tariff rate. It is going to affect those companies that do business in the US severely, because the president's announcing interventions that the government's going to take. No one's entirely clear on what these interventions will do. And essentially it's trying to say, well, you know, we didn't get it. We didn't do what was required of us. We conceded on nothing that mattered most to the U.S. administration. And so now the government's trying to show that it can create an environment in which South African companies will somehow be compensated or assisted by South Africa for failing to achieve this. Now, where some of such assistance is going to come from, I have absolutely no idea. It can't be financial, and financial is probably all that matters, because we really don't have the money to make up for the costs that South African companies would have to bear in exporting to the US. Our regulations, our Expropriation Act, BEE, farm murders, whatever the issues are that really upset the United States, we don't look like getting beyond that. So I think we can probably say that the effect of the failure to mitigate against the threatened 30% tariffs will have hugely detrimental impact on various sectors. And the one in particularly is the motor sector and the Eastern Cape in particular. Now, Cyril Ramaphosa has praised BMW's plans to manufacture a new X3 plug-in hybrid car at Rosslyn in Pretoria, but has said nothing about the potential job crisis that could be coming in the Eastern Cape. His really comment on it amounted to this: the industry is under growing pressure. The introduction of stricter vehicle emissions regulations in leading export destinations such as the European Union, as well as new tariffs in the United States, are expected to have a significant impact on the sector. So just to make the fact that the government did less than nothing and exacerbated the financial crisis hitting the motor sector in the Eastern Cape, it sought to raise the requirements of the EU and other parties. But those requirements have to have been there for some time. So, you know, it's... let's say it's been factored in. Now, the National Union of Metal Workers have responded to a shutdown at Mercedes-Benz and a period of short time has been introduced at 26 companies in the Eastern Cape, many based around Gqeberha and surrounds. The Eastern Cape Finance MEC, Mungizi Mvoku, said that Mercedes-Benz, which exports more than 90% of its vehicles to the US, how's that for a whammy, posed the most risk of withdrawal from South Africa. He was part of a delegation that actually went to Stuttgart in Germany to engage Mercedes-Benz. I don't know how it can possibly engage Mercedes-Benz, but it's really got nothing to offer them in the same way that it's got nothing to offer anyone else to mitigate its political policy failures on the international stage, and specifically with respect to the United States. So bloodletting is probably going to begin, hopefully metaphorically, not literally.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, in all the hurly-burly of South African politics, my colleague Terence Corrigan, the irrepressible and ever knowledgeable, wrote an article headlined "An Important Durco Statement Goes Ignored." Now, essentially, and he's very well suited, given his experience in and of Taiwan, to explain this. But the nuts and bolts of it is that because of South Africa's commitment to the One China policy, that is recognizing the People's Republic of China, Communist China, South Africa has called upon Taipei to relocate its commercial office from the capital, Pretoria, to Johannesburg, which is more appropriate given its status as the country's economic hub. Terence, could you unpack that for us? It seems like a very strange, nasty little action that was not necessary, let alone anything else.
No. Look, there's a lot going on there. This, I think, in its broadest terms, is the kind of sort of venal, self-important, performative art that often substitutes for governance. The reality is that South Africa has no diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Now, you know, obviously, I have my own views about that, but that is the reality. So whether there is a Taipei liaison office in Pretoria or in Johannesburg or in Kuruman, it's really conceptually no different from, let's say, the World Wildlife Fund or a foreign company. the South African state doesn't really interact with it and doesn't recognize it. But what this is saying is it's kind of like the diplomatic equivalent of a middle finger. It's saying we don't like you, we don't want you around, you smell bad. Why are they doing this? Well, I think there's a part of the ANC, and I think this is very well represented in Durko and its foreign affairs bureaucracy, that has an exaggerated sense of its own importance and its own agency in history. And what it's signaling here is, you know, we stand with our Chinese comrades, and I worry that there is some sort of back of mind thinking that the world is heading towards this apocalyptic showdown, and South Africa is going to ride with China. Now, point is, whatever one may think of that, South Africa is, you know, would sort of be a mosquito on the back of the Chinese elephant. It would mean essentially nothing.
Mm.
But this is kind of a way of delivering your tribute. I would like to say that this is because of Chinese pressure, but I doubt it.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think this is about a spontaneous demonstration of loyalty.
Mm.
Perhaps this was suggested by a Chinese diplomat, but it's also the kind of thing that you could just shrug off, you know. Mm. Taiwan has been willing to sort of accept the situation, and this, yeah, it's, as I say, it's petty, it's venal, and South Africa does have a sizable economic stake in that relationship, which is one reason why it's been retained. Also, I'm told there are diplomatic conventions about this. If there is an agreement. Between the state and some sort of extranational government, you cannot simply unilaterally alter that. You have to actually negotiate it.
Mm.
And I believe that's a very, very well established principle. And you can't just tell the World Wildlife Foundation to relocate.
Mm.
So I think that there may well be a legal issue here. But yeah, this is Durko in its comfort zone. This is Durko saying we are ideological. We are, we are signaling where South Africa fits in, and it just seems at the current conjunction that's maybe something that you just want to, you know, park aside for a moment, because remember the issue of Taiwan was actually been raised by American legislators who feel that South Africa is not non-aligned, and I mean, I could have told them that. They just had to make a call to me, but okay, they worked this one out for themselves. Look, there's a sense of irony because the United States technically doesn't recognize Taiwan either.
Mm.
But the point is that Taiwan is integrated into that sort of American web of alliances. It is an area of the world where a shooting war could start that could ultimately end with big mushroom clouds.
Mm.
It's not just about the Yankee imperialists or the unity of the Chinese people, depending on which side of the issue you're on. It's integral to the security of South Korea and Japan, which is why Japan would probably be drawn in.
Mm.
And then also the same impulses that are leading, or related impulses that are leading China to make the claim on Taiwan, affects a belt of countries all the way down to Australia. Chinese intrusion into Filipino waters, claims of that whole South China Sea, the construction of artificial islands. So this is something that is not, you know, it may seem performative, but I wonder whether, I doubt very much whether South Africa's diplomatic representatives really understand the issues. In fact, I'm quite sure they don't.
Mm. Well, it's interesting you say that, because essentially what you're saying is that realpolitik means that Taiwan, in the current circumstances, does not have diplomatic relations with probably a large swathe of the world.
Yeah.
But but the other side of realpolitik is that Taiwan produces, what I think it's nearly 90% of the world's semiconductors, and the world literally cannot operate without that.
Yes.
Given the way the U.S. has required us to, or expected of us to act in order to reset their trade relationships and attract lower tariffs, which we didn't manage to do because we didn't manage to do it, you'd think that a little relatively small gesture like this would be completely unnecessary in the circumstances. There's so much else that we haven't done that America wants us to do. Expropriation Act, getting rid of BE, etc. And if you say that China is unlikely to have demanded it or probably even cared one way or the other at this stage, it really isn't in reality an issue. It does seem extraordinarily gratuitous. As you say, I mean, did they literally wake up one morning and say, I think we must piss off the United States a bit more and, be seen to solidify our allyship with China? I don't know. It's like, sorry.
Well, look, my sense of that, sadly, is that there probably is an element of, yes, let's stick it in America's eye. I think that maybe it's not something that's clearly articulated, but I think that is very much a sort of underlying axiom that is, as I say, maybe not articulated, but the idea that we are anti-imperialist.
Which in this instance is quite ironic, because essentially China is saying, well, here we are. We are an empire, and you've called them an empire, and I think that's right. We've done Hong Kong. We've done Tibet. Now we're going to do Taiwan.
We've created
these islands, etc. We want everyone. Who's the imperialist?
If one has sort of any understanding of that part of the world, you look at the Vietnamese, for instance. They've had a conflict with the Chinese that goes back to like the 7th century or something like that. They've been invaded multiple times, most recently in 1979, the last time China fought a proper war. If you speak to Vietnamese people about the idea of colonization and imperialism, they're not going to point at America, they'll point to China. Which is why the Vietnam War was just basically historically going out for a beer for them. They actually call it the American War. It's just one of them. But their orientation is always what's on their northern border. China's claimed the entire South China Sea. The Philippines has actually took them to the to an international maritime tribunal. China which ruled in the Philippines' favor. China just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said they're going to ignore it. And Durko put out a statement, sort of mealy-mouthing about, countries must work these things out. All of a sudden, multilateralism and the institutions of global governance didn't count that much. We must do these things bilaterally. Just so happens that one is a nuclear-armed power and the other is not. That's convenient. As far as China being an empire as well, it means Tibet, Xinjiang. They've also incidentally got designs on parts of Siberia.
Yes, of course.
Of course, there's the line of control with them in India. For all this talk about BRICS being the future,
you take out the R, I, and C out of BRICS, and you've got nothing.
Yeah, look, the Chinese, I will give them this. They have 5,000 years of history in statecraft. They're not stupid, and they can be brutally pragmatic. The People's Republic is standing in a long tradition of Chinese diplomacy that does things for China and their interests as they see them. And I think South Africa, I doubt very much that we have any that our diplomatic corps has any real understanding of what makes them tick.
Well, I noticed when they released the list of gifts that parliamentarians have acquired. One parliamentarian, I just forget who offhand, received from the People's Republic, I think, boxes of Lindt chocolate. And, you know, while they may want all our mineral resources that they could use for whatever purpose they need, they're really not, you're not going to see investment in South Africa from China per se. Nothing is going to be, very little is likely to be reciprocal. Is it more about ideology and less about trade, particularly as we have so many rules in place to make even those desirable rare resources difficult to extract?
Look, the South Africa has received some investment from China, but you know, but investment is really what makes a country grow, and it pales into comparison. Alongside the Japanese or the Americans or the Europeans, called the free world, if I can use an old phrase. They are very important for trade, but this is something that even the South African government has complained about. We tend to ship raw materials and they tend to ship us manufactured goods. Now, as a SOP, they, have been, willing to sort of assemble certain things. There's a car plant in Pretoria now. There's bits and pieces there, and they can, in a sense, do it because the idea of private capital is a very flexible concept in China. So a lot of this is, they'll do it because there's some sort of plaudits. But ultimately, they... China has established a sort of trading a trading system that fundamentally benefits itself. The big concerns all around the world about its currency manipulation, about effective subsidies for its industry, also about barriers to importing. So they're not free traders; they're mercantilists. But once again, I think funnily enough, Donald Trump probably got the measure of them in his first term when he said, "Well, she's for China and I'm for the United States." And I think the first part of that is definitely true. Xi Jinping is about China, and not about BRICS, not about the Global South, not about South Africa. If South Africa is willing to play along, well, the Chinese are going to be quite happy with that. I would also say the influence has not always been malign. The Chinese had a long chat to Nelson Mandela prior to the transition and said, "This whole nationalization thing, we did it didn't work. Don't do it." So, and the Vietnamese too, incidentally. But I do think that what has happened in the interim is that China's priorities have shifted. That sort of technocratic modernization generation has been replaced by the aggrandizers, Xi Jinping and whatever. Plus, Chinese politics, I don't think is as stable as we assume. It's been noted that Xi has not taken his wife or family members on foreign trips with him. And there's a thought that this could be a case of, we're just keeping a bit of leverage on you at home. There's apparently a lot of discontent in the military with his leadership. South Africa, though, I think sees the world through a highly parochial and highly ideological lens. And I think in many ways it's still stuck in the 1960s where China simply falls in for the Soviet Union. China and the Soviet Union are not, not the same thing. The Soviets, in a way, were by that stage a status quo power. They had their empire and was kind of understood. We don't shoot at you directly. You don't shoot at us directly, but we can go at each other in the periphery. China doesn't think in those terms.
What you say about Xi is interesting because there have been numerous articles, and if ever there's a subject that has articles written on one side of the argument and then articles written on the other side, but the fact that he has been seen less, there's a growing sense that his all empowering position all-empowered position is just not as solid as it once was. Also, China's huge financial problems, particularly with respect to with overbuilding and land, land with huge amounts built and debt owed, and it's been a property bubble has risen in China that is absolutely huge, and the demography of China is really a problem. There really are fewer people having fewer children, and that was few enough given the one-child policy that lasted until relatively recently.
You know, I can just embroider that a little bit. The one-child policy was not only kind of inverted the population pyramid. It's being now compounded by the fact that in that coastal zone, many people have essentially reached, call it a first world standard of living. Those people don't have children, universal or don't have as many children. The other thing is that the One China policy was paired with a cultural preference for boys. So there's something like a surplus of 30 million males, I once heard. Those are people who are not going to find partners, who are going to be frustrated, and that has a demographic compound. One thing must be said, though, is that all of those fast developing Asian countries have that problem. Taiwan has it as well. Japan, South Korea, which, you know, perhaps that's the sort of saving grace, that you don't want to, countries with lots of 50-year-olds don't want to go to war with one another.
Can't. Take it from me. Terence, I'd like to leave the conversation there if we may, time constraints, but I have asked you to hang on to the next item, which I was going to talk through, but I'll talk through and get your views on it. It's not a cast in stone. So we'll come back to that after the ads.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
On the 12th of October 2023, the Institute of Race Relations issued a very strongly worded press statement criticizing the government for failing to condemn Hamas's attacks on Israel on the 7th of October, 5 days before. And it talked about the government not containing a whisper of condemnation for the Hamas attacks, but rather calling for sort of calm in the Middle East and essentially blaming Israel for whatever had happened. It was also a very prescient media study as to what was likely to happen as a consequence. It's worth looking at another time. But it was responding to a media release put out by the ANC on the 8th of October. Now, that was, for the South African government, an extraordinarily swift media release. Our government not being given generally to doing things very quickly. But a few months later, I was looking at the subject for, I think, writing an article, and I was looking for the media release. And I came upon it, and it's still there, on the Derco's website, dated 7 October. And I sort of muttered, and I think people generally thought, you know, it was all too chaotic and unreal to consider it maybe seriously. But I thought, if it was written on the 7th of October and Hamas was busy attacking, pillaging and raping and murdering on the 7th of October, where would the ANC, and the ANC put out a similar statement, where would the ANC and the government have got the information that would warrant such a fast and sort of protective media statement as it did? Now, I've heard a number of people talk publicly about the fact that South Africa did know what was coming, if not obviously necessarily in its exact terms, and it was part of a plan between Hamas and South Africa, and probably Hamas and other players, to head off and start directing the attention of what was going to happen to land squarely on the Israelis sooner rather than later. And this may have consequences on the validity of the ICJ case that South Africa took to the court. And there's even talk of an application to have that struck off. Terence, am I being a bit fanciful, or are we really looking at a possibility that South Africa was more than just suddenly efficient?
Okay. I take the Carl Sagan route on this, and I say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Now, this has been alleged. I gather there's a guy in the UK who mm-hmm. reckons he's got evidence. Now, I await this. Mm-hmm. My sense, though, is that if I had to construct what I would consider a plausible scenario, I think that our state in general is too chaotic to talk of, you know, the South African government being aware. Mm. I believe that it is possible that certain people within Durco may have known that some sort of militant action was coming. As far as the court case goes and the stigma, look, there's very little that has come out that has come out of South Africa since October the 7th in respect of Israel that is unexpected or that we haven't seen before. And I've said this, but I believe that in terms of South Africa's foreign projection and in terms of the ANC's position, their views of Israel essentially is now an eliminationist. Mm-hmm. I don't think that. I mean, do we even hear the term two-state solution anymore? River to the sea, et cetera, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. So that is, so I think that in that sense, there is a certain simpatico between some people in Durko and the Hamas line. It's been suggested to me by one observer that what's happened is that we've just had clueless politicians overseeing this, but there is a sort of core of highly ideological, highly involved, and in their own terms, very hardworking bureaucrats who've taken control of foreign policy. I could imagine a situation where perhaps there's been a little bit of policy freelancing, which is not outside of the broad scope of the South African state, but not entirely known to its principal agents, and I think as far as the court case goes, I think that something like that has probably been in the works for a long time. They were looking for an opportunity to spring it. Now, that statement, I remember reading it and thinking, this is very much actually like the way that Clayson Moniela was talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You could almost forget who was wielding the machete at the time. and it was talking about, you know, this latest escalation for which Israel is entirely responsible. There's no sense that actually these were, you know, Hamas paragliders going into music festivals and doing their dreadful thing. So, you know, I would also, let's say, I would, for clarity, say that I'm not accusing someone like John Dugard of being complicit here. I think he's got his own agenda, and I think probably very sincere in it. But the idea that South Africa was going to intervene, it was waiting for the right moment. And what this is about fundamentally, I think, is an information war. Someone from, I think it was Africa for Palestine, said, well, now we can use Israel and genocide in the same sentence. And that, to my mind, is probably more dangerous to Israel than, you know, 100 October the 7th.
In the long run, it probably is.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, ek wag op die kaptein, as we say in Afrikaans. I before I commit to that, look, just let me say, if this was known, that makes South Africa complete. That makes the South African state, even if it's not, you know, at the level of the foreign minister or the president, complicit in an act of terrorism directed at civilians. Mm. And I don't think you walk back from that. Mm. You know, it's not just Israel or America or Germany or whatever. Countries like India have, you know, remember the Mumbai attacks? Mm. In some ways parallels October the 7th. I think that would send a massive shockwave. You know, I do think that's something to bear in mind here. there's been some commentary about how the, you know, this represents the kind of Islam, you know, Muslim influence within Durko, and I would push back against that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this is a matter of people's, you know, personal ethnic background, although perhaps that maybe inclines you to a certain narrative or whatever. I think I think though that for people steeped in this revolutionary romance, there's something irresistible about an organization like Hamas. It's not willing to surrender. Mm. It's doing the armed struggle. It's paragliding into music festivals. You know, now that's there's a revolutionary romanticism about it. Mm. Irrespective of what you may think about the kind of society it would advocate, and I think also, unfortunately, this is not something that's been that to which any thought is given.
Mm.
I mean, look, I've said this before. I'm very much in favor of the establishment of a Palestinian state, but I'm very, very concerned about what that's going to look like.
Yeah,
take Israel out of the equation completely.
As would we all be concerned.
Yeah, well, as would the Jordanians be, for instance.
Terence, thank you for just riffing on that subject with me post the original subject, and we'll see you again soon.
I look forward to it, Sarah.
Thanks.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
There are definitely signs that if the will is there and the competence and drive to realize it are manifest, things can change in our murky world of murky tenders and criminality in general. And this is to be found in the Department of Public Works, the minister being Dean McPherson of the DA. There are a number of things that's happened recently, and we don't have the time to go into it, but just to give you a sense of it, he has suspended expanded works program funds to a municipality in the Free State, pending investigations into alleged politically connected individuals receiving, guess what, inflated salaries through the program. They're essentially earning 10 times more than the amount that is given to people, or marked for people to get in terms of that scheme. But on an entirely different level, he released a forensic report into an irregular oxygen plant tender to the tune of 836 million rand. Now, the thing about this tender is it was put out by the Independent Development Trust, which is a government agency that looks at the built environment and project manages and delivers integrated public infrastructure programs. Well, this tender is huge. It's, as I say, 836 million rands worth. It's just blown up compared to what it was meant to be. And essentially, that the largest portion of this project was obtained by what they refer to as a ghost company. They didn't hold the necessary certification in dealing with medical equipment. The report recommends a 400 IDT employees be flagged for lifestyle audits. A new IDT board has already been put in place. And it was meant to be to the benefit of 55 hospitals to allow them to generate oxygen without relying on having cylinders delivered on a constant basis for doing so. The initial budget was 260 million rand. So all of this has been referred to the Hawks, the police, the Special Investigating Unit, and the National Prosecuting Authority. And it is, as most of these things, it's wide, it's deep, and it's complex. So it will take a long time to see what comes out of it. But there we have it. You know, something can be done. And by all accounts, I read a report some time ago that the said same department, together with the police, are actually making some inroads into dealing with construction mafias. So obviously, if you have the right people in place, something can happen. My final kudos go out, however, to essentially our new swimming champion. Peter Kutsia at the World Championships managed to bag three medals for three backstroke races, and he's one of the very few people, apparently the only second South African, to win three medals at the World Championship. And he's 100 meter backstroke champion and was second in the 200 meters backstroke. Clearly, you know, South Africans with the talent and the hard work can show that we can do it, and we can really achieve. Pity the government doesn't understand that its role should be to get out of the way but make life easier for those who can do for the benefit of themselves and for everyone else. And with that, we've come to the end of the show. Sara's going rogue elsewhere, and we'll chat next week. Thanks.